Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Will Cocker. Will has spent more than 20 years as a senior editor, writer, and consultant for national magazines, including Men's Journal, Outside, Men's Fitness, and GQ. His work has been awarded by the American Society of Magazine Editors and Professional Publishers Association, UK. He's a former outdoor guide, and he has covered Everest throughout his career and has visited Everest Base Camp in Nepal. He lives with his family in Los Angeles, California, and his website is his name, willcockrell.com. And we're going to be discussing his book, Everest Inc., The Renegades and Rogues Who Built an Industry at the Top of the World. So, Will, I want to welcome you to The Deep Dive. How are you?
I'm doing good today. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, I'm really excited to have this conversation. And people who are frequent listeners of the show will probably laugh because I do say that all the time, but it's sincere because each guest is so unique and always has such an exciting perspective. And when I got an opportunity to get your book, I was really excited about it because it's a topic that I think on first blush, folks would say like, oh, you know, why are you on the show? Right. But when I read a little bit about the book and then obviously I read the book, I realize there's a perfect fit because so much of what you're discussing and talking about is, in my eyes, very culture based. You know, the industry upon which this sort of extreme mountain climbing, particularly when focused on Mount Everest, is very much a insular culture, but I think it has many lessons, messages, and insights that are applicable whether you're climbing a mountain or not. My editorial. So I'm very excited to be engaged in this conversation. So I want to give you an opportunity to give us your perspective on why you chose this topic, particularly viewing Everest as Mount Everest as an industry.
Yeah, well, I've covered the mountain for so long in my career, and probably the most memorable era on the mountain, of course, is the era of guiding, right? So the guiding industry, you know, in simple terms, it's this era in which less experienced, even inexperienced people pay mountain guides to help get them to the top. And in a surprisingly high number of cases, they succeed. Non-climbers, average Joes and Janes, and people from these wide spectrums of culture, countries, ages, backgrounds, summit Mount Everest. And that is such a stark difference from the era that preceded it, actually the couple eras that preceded it, in which it was just to even get to the top of the mountain. It was really a climber's story, and it was like this man against nature thing where it actually was deemed unclimbable, suicide, basically, for so long. And then we finally did it. And then, boom, you have 40 years going from it seemed suicidal to now, you know, 600 people a year summit and many more try. I truly see that as you put it, like a cultural phenomenon, it's a thing. Everest is a thing in our culture now. It's no longer a climber's story. And so that was my impetus for doing it, because I've been so familiar with all those stories over the years. And I will say that the book turned out to be a counter narrative to everything we think we know about Mount Everest. All the stories we've heard, all the tragedies, you know, all the sort of shock value stuff that has popped up over the last 35 years, people think they know what that adds up to. And it actually is very different, and that's where the book goes.
And that was also another reason why I was excited about the book. And I agree with you. I think it is a counter narrative, because I'm a city kid, right? So let me like underscore that, underline it, and shout it from the rooftops. Like, I don't know shit about climbing anything but stairs up and down New York City and to go into subway and stuff like that, right? Like, I've been on some hikes, but they gentle, right? Yeah. Like, right. Nothing at all. Like,
right.
What I've seen from this world, right? So one of my very like memorable, I guess, recollections of Mount Everest, beyond, I think everyone in the world knows what Mount Everest is in this period, I guess this newer era when people are now laymen, regular people, have the ability to scale the mountain. There was, I don't know how many years ago this was, but there were tons of, there's this long line and there was all this like trash and it just was like all these discarded like tents and just all this stuff, right? And I remember my reaction being like, oh, these people are fucking assholes, right? Like, you know,
yep.
This is why we can't have nice things, right? Like, right. We have this, yep, this beautiful mountain and this amazing thing that people risk their life to kind of guide people up and down. And yet here are these douchebags, you know, that have no, seemingly to my notion, as I sit on my couch, have no respect for this, right? And that's kind of been burned in my head. And that was one, that was another reason why I wanted to read the book, right? To learn more about that. So I want to give you an opportunity to talk about that image, because I think that image is one of the most memorable images, and you do reflect on that in the book.
Well, you touched on probably the biggest one, which we'll call the conga line photo.
Yeah.
2019, right? There was that a photo went super viral of a long line of people waiting to get to the summit of Mount Everest. It was a stunning photo. I mean, I'm not going to judge good or bad, but it was a stunning photo, and I can see why it grabbed so much attention. You have other cultural milestones throughout the last 40 years on history on Everest, right? One of the earliest being Jon Krakauer's famous book, Into Thin Air, right? That was another cultural milestone that, you know, people kind of like basically learned everything they wanted to learn about Everest in that book. And that was forever their idea of what that mountain's about. You're not totally wrong. I'm not going to say that there aren't douchebags on Mount Everest and that, you know, and that there remain some issues. But what the book does and what I loved finding is that behind each of these cultural milestones that we do know and the headlines, like that photo, there's a backstory and a context that really turns it into something that is completely unlike probably what 99.9% of the headlines that went along with that photo or the caption or the way people walked away from it. I suppose you could call my book that context. You know what I mean? Is you know, if you read the book and get up to that moment, that 2019 moment, you're going to see it completely differently than the first time you saw it on the front cover of the New York Times or whatever it was at the time. That would be my take. And going into the project, I had a hunch that there was more to these cultural milestones than what we reduced them to, right? I knew enough of the players. I knew enough about the mountain. I knew enough about the industry myself to say, I just know it's not that simple. I just know. And I will say, too, with these stories that in some way we've gotten into a bad habit going all the way back to Krakauer. I think every story begins with the idea that Mount Everest is broken and a giant accident waiting to happen. Then enter the story. You get it? So it's the conga line. It's all these other things that happen, but that's the backstory that everyone's reading those stories by. And that story is not quite right. It's pretty far off the truth, actually.
And it's interesting that you bring up this notion of Mount Everest being broken, because it is a living part of our natural world. It can neither be broken or not broken. It merely is, right? So in some ways, I guess we get an opportunity to project what we want onto this mountain. I start from a place of, actually, maybe it is because I'm such a city kid and have no capability to do these things, but incredible respect and majesty for something that just seems of another world, even though it is of this world. So I think that's where the reaction to those types of pictures and images come from, right? Like, again, we have this unspoiled, is one of the few things that we could say are unspoiled, right? Relative to Brooklyn, for example. But yet here come people to somehow spoil the unspoilable, right? And I'm not going to give away everything in the book, right? Because we want people to go out there and get the book. But I do want to talk broadly about these two periods, which, well, two or maybe two to three eras that you remarked on earlier, where there was a certain level of expertise and sacrifice that went into cresting Mount Everest that seems to be removed when you now have this industry of guided tours, right? And I want to give you an opportunity to reflect on, is this good, right? Like, you know, like, anybody who knows me knows that I would say, like, hell nah, ain't good, right? Like, you have these lunatics going up something. Like, don't they have to earn it, right? Like, shouldn't you have to, like, earn this?
One of the things that I actually try to set up early in the book, because it's the ever-present question, who deserves to be on Mount Everest and who doesn't deserve to be there? And what I really, really do quite quickly in Everest Inc. is I begin to dismantle that question. It's kind of a useless question of who deserves to be there and who doesn't. And I'll explain as briefly as I can why. I would say that comparing these two eras that you're talking about, the pre-guiding and then guiding, you know, I agree and admit that it could be a pretty lively debate to say that Mount Everest is broken in climbing and mountaineering terms. There did come a turning point when the idea of doing the impossible, doing something new, having it fit into that category of unexplored and untouched, that did go away. That's true, right? But the idea that Mount Everest is broken, that's dead wrong, because what we shifted into is an era in which the stewards of the mountains were no longer the climbers, right? The elite climbers with really strong opinions about climbing and who should be there and who shouldn't. The stewards of the mountain were all of a sudden the Sherpa people who lived in the Khumbu Valley, basically lived at the foot of Everest, right? And they were basically a part of the guiding industry from the very beginning, right? A huge part. And then you had mountain guides. And you don't have to really learn much about mountain guides, or you just meet one time and you just realize that, like, these people love the wild and, like, our natural world and the ethics of being in these natural places as much as anyone. You know, these tend to be very, very conscious, educated people in terms of preserving these places. The only difference being, they have a weird burning fire inside them that they enjoy getting other people to the top of mountains more than summiting themselves. And, you know, many of those who take people to the top of Mount Everest spend the rest of the year getting people to the top of other easier mountains over and over and over and over. So those are the new stewards of the mountain. So that's precisely why I was willing to set out on this idea that it's not broken at all. The mountain guides and the Sherpas have guided it into an impressive place. And the only piece that may be different that people don't understand is that Mount Everest may not be in the conversation, in the climbing conversation anymore. Although it is. I could geek out about a solo winter ascent has still not been done. There's a lot of things that haven't been done on Mount Everest. And so, but that's fine. Mount Everest is now more of like a cultural thing that is a symbol for anyone. You know, all of a sudden it's like running a marathon. You know, a lot of people who run marathons, they aren't runners per se. In fact, they may have hate running before they decided to do it, but the marathon felt like something they needed to do in their life. That's where I put it.
Yeah, I kind of hear you. Color me slightly unconvinced, right? Only because, I mean, I've never run a marathon, but I was a runner. Right. And I was a distance runner, but I've never attempted a marathon again. Too lazy for all that. Right.
Right. Right.
But I'm sure there's some exceptions out there. So I know if when I say this, folks are going to email me telling me, well, that's not true. My friend did this. But for the most part, a person doesn't like, if you plan to do the New York City Marathon, you do train for that marathon. Like you
right.
prepare yeah. for the marathon. Like you spend probably upwards to 6 months on the low end, but probably 9 to a year going out, running, getting at least the ability to like complete the marathon on your own, right? Like there's no one kind of putting you on their back and like running with you to complete the marathon. Whether it takes you 3 hours or it takes you 8 hours, you got to finish it, right? And with Everest, again, I'm a layman, right? Like, what do I know? I'm in Brooklyn. It just feels like these folks, like some of these folks are going there like for the photo op, and they willing to do the least. Like it's the opposite of the training. It's like, what's the least that I could do based on how much I could pay to do this, to check it off a box? I want to live, of course, but I don't want to do that much work. And, yeah. and this, it comes with work, right? Like there's no way you can avoid the work because you can't breathe up there. You get sick, the weather conditions, all of that. So I don't think that people are being like literally carried up on like a someone's back. Like that was just
yeah.
a throwback to the old school Simpsons episode where Homer tried to climb this mountain, had a couple of Sherpas just kind of pushing him up the yeah. mountain as he slept, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know if there's a question in there, but do you get where I'm kind of hemming and hawing a little bit?
No, I appreciate that, because I think what you are expressing is probably what most people would say about today, about Everest today. And I've got a couple things there. My caveat here is I have not climbed Mount Everest. Okay. So anything I say in which I'm sort of imagining what certain things are like is all through the interviews I've done and the people I've seen and what I know about the mountain. But I remember someone once talking about, you know, oh, if you run marathons and you're curious if climbing Mount Everest is harder, strap a table to your back and then run a marathon. And then that's what it's like to climb Mount Everest. And I do think it's fair to say that climbing Mount Everest, not just the climb itself, but living at base camp at 17,500 feet for 6 to 8 weeks is way harder than running a marathon. In fact, I might put it in the category, if we're just looking at athletic achievements, I'd put it more like maybe an Ironman or something. And when I was working on the book, probably one of the most difficult things to reconcile is exactly what you were talking about. I was at base camp. I spent time at base camp as people were getting ready to climb Everest in that season. And there were a lot of people there who I would say fall in that category of really the reason they were there was to get an Instagram photo at the top. There were a lot of influencers, and certain companies cater to those influencers. And base camp has become quite luxurious. But I have huge questions in my mind whether I could ever climb Mount Everest. And I've been a climber my whole life. And so there's a part of me that says, no matter why you're there, no matter what that personal reason is, and I'm with you, I can't help but feel kind of put off by the people who want an Instagram photo and then they'll never climb a mountain ever again in their life. Like, I find that like tragic, right? Because it's just such an amazing, beautiful experience to climb these mountains. How do you not get addicted? A lot of these people never put a crampon on again in their life. But it doesn't matter. I was watching these people come up, and then hearing later when I wasn't there that which ones summited and which ones didn't. And sometimes I was just like, no way, that person summited? And again, I can't help but no matter what anybody says, if they're talking down about it, is to get up to the top of Mount Everest and to live at base camp that entire time is ridiculously hard. Yeah, and take right? something inside, some fire inside gets them, you know, got them to the top. And the only other thing I'd say is that the impression of clients that we have, the ones that put the crampons on backwards, the ones that want to be kind of pulled up the mountain, they're the exception, not the rule. And the guides flat out will tell you, you know, they're honest. They'll be like, yeah, 1 year, you know, I had 11 amazing people and there was a 12th that I literally was bringing the whole group, you know, was causing all these problems. And it's just like any setting. It's just, there's, you know, there's some selfish people in there. There's some, narcissists. There's, you know, people who do just want to be dragged up. And you know what? The Sherpa guides and the Western guides, there's no one they hate more.
I can imagine. I want to talk about the Sherpas, right? Because again, only speaking as a layman, there's, you know, I think it's something that people think they know what it means, both as a profession, but then as a community. And one of the most interesting things in the book is the time that you spent kind of talking about Sherpa community and their thoughts and opinions on now what is the business of Mount Everest. So I want to give you an opportunity to kind of give us more of a sense of not just the specific role of the Sherpa when it comes to climbing Mount Everest, but how that ties so much to their way of life and community.
Yeah. So, you know, I never like talking down to people and assume like, for instance, that they know nothing, but I do make that one point in my book that I think is always worth making, which is, you know, a Sherpa is not a profession. Sherpa does not mean porter. So a Sherpa is not a person who carries things. A Sherpa is a Nepalese person that lives in the Khumbu Valley. So first of all, it's just an ethnicity. It's like saying you're Canadian, right? You're a Sherpa. It just means the part of Nepal you live in. The Sherpas have been part of the guiding industry since the very beginning, right? First, they were part of the climbing expeditions as porters. Then they were being staffed probably triple times because they were cooking, they were building the structures, building camp, flattening, you know, rock and ice to put tents down. The guiding industry needed to hire a lot of locals to do that work. The strongest became porters that would go further and further up the mountain. So what you had over this 35-year period was you had Sherpas from the valley making what in Nepal terms was incredible money that trickled down valley to their families. They were building guest houses that basically would allow them to make a living for the rest of their lives, tea houses, restaurants. You know, the Khumbu Valley is there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of really amazing, cool little villages, I'll call them, on the way. And it's pretty prosperous in comparison to the rest of Nepal. And I think that all the Sherpas had to do was look at what the Khumbu Valley was becoming and say, yeah, we're in. However, there did come a time when the inordinate amount of Sherpa deaths and some of the inequality in what tasks Sherpa climbers were doing and Western guides climbers were doing, there was a gap that would rightfully make anyone look sideways and be like, I don't know about this. Feels pretty colonial to me. Well, in wrapping that story up, and again, I don't want to give too much away in Everest Inc., but I got lucky because the Sherpa story, what it's become, just goes to show sort of where it was headed. There were some bumps. There were some really difficult moments. Probably the worst being when the 16 Sherpas got killed in an avalanche at once in 2014, that immediately highlighted sort of the problems that were happening. But Western guides began to facilitate more training for the Sherpas. When I say training, they went from being trained in load carrying, essentially, and a little bit of crampon technique, to becoming certified mountain guide. And slowly, there was an evolution in which they were becoming counterparts, peers of the Western guides, not working for the Western guides. And we now have an industry that is entirely run by Nepalese, with the Westerners on the fringe. And that just goes to show, I guess, that the arc, thankfully, was headed in that direction. That thankfully, we went through some pretty rough patches, and it ended up where the Nepalese wanted it to end up.
And I'm glad we got a chance to kind of talk about the broader Nepalese kind of arc, you know, as you highlighted. Because one of the things that I was curious as I was reading through the history, and I was saying to myself, is would all this have been possible in a backdrop or country that was more economically well off? Meaning, if Mount Everest was in a place where there was just more wealth in the community, would an industry like this would it have grown to the point that it is now if Sherpas had other things to do, right? Like if they weren't thinking about the mountain as a source of economic well-being and economy and just something that was there, right? And folks kind of did other things. You know, it's a complete abstraction, but I feel the environment itself is also part of the story. Like I think you did a really exceptional job to kind of talk about the shared geographies that are in the entire region, Nepal, China. And so it felt like Nepal is also part of this story, so to speak.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you touch on something pretty interesting, which is if money weren't the driving factor, not just money, like let's be specific. I mean, like food on the table for their children, being able to send their children to schools, which became the big one. So they would send their children to schools in Kathmandu. Now you have this incredibly well-educated Sherpa population who are like airline pilots and engineers in Nepal because of the Everest industry. But I think that things could have been quite different if there was no motivating factor like that, right? As I point out with the Sherpas, the mountains are considered sacred and they're really not meant to be climbed, right? That was a bad omen if you had to be hiking and climbing up on the mountains themselves. And so there's a lot of, you could make the argument that it never would have happened. I think that the mountain guides, the owners of these guiding industries early on, they were able to justify bringing this population into the climbing industry, able to justify saying, hey, we're going to pay you a couple thousand dollars for the season, you know, to come schlep stuff around, cook. This is before they had the skills to do much else. I think part of the reason why they justified it is because, don't forget, these were climbers that started this industry. They weren't businessmen at all. It's not like they had done the numbers and said, oh, let's go, like a developer and decided this is the next big thing. They were climbers. And climbers are unique and strange in that they take some pretty unnecessary risks doing something for, I'm going to use the word fun, right? They do not have to climb these mountains. They find the mountains to be a transformative place. They believe that climbing mountains is man at its sort of most divine and challenged, and it's going to push you and you become a different person when you start to climb these mountains. And so I think when the Sherpas started traveling through the Khumbu Icefall, for example, or traveling higher up on the mountain, which they were, you know, they began doing as they got more skilled, that risk factor, the fact that they could lose their life, the fact that they could end up leaving their family without a head of household, you know, these are climbers. And, you know, I think they were kind of like saying, there's also the majesty of the mountains. It's an amazing place to work. I think there is a debate whether that's fair to the local population or not. But I do think, again, the proof is in how many of these Sherpas have immersed themselves into the industry without needing to.
Got it. And I want to keep on this theme a little bit and ask.
Yeah.
And this is probably ties in a lot of the earlier points about who deserves, who doesn't deserve a little bit. I think to myself, there's this incredible, just majestic mountain that exists within these two borders, and it doesn't belong to anybody, but, you know, obviously people regulate these things, right? Kind of like Port Authority, right? Atlantic Ocean doesn't belong to anybody, but hey, New York and New Jersey kind of tells ships and bridges and tunnels and collects tolls and all the rest of it, right? So we get that commerce enters into the natural world. But I was curious to get your thoughts as someone who has spent a lot of time and visited. Is there an argument to be made that the value, the long-term value of all of this increases with more regulation, more restrictions toward number of bodies going up on any given period? Wouldn't the certificates and the licenses become more, like even more expensive if, hey, we're not letting 600 people go up this year, right? We're limiting this to 250, right? You know, like, why is there not a less is more thinking when it comes to the long-term ecosystem for everyone involved, right? Because you do talk about the physical tolls that this takes on the mountain guides, the Sherpas, everyone involved. the more you go, the more you make, right? And that's a kind of a dangerous cycle to get into.
Well, so the one word answer is Nepal, right? I think that, you know, you kind of have to have traveled around the world a little bit and seen the inner workings of developing countries and, you know, how they build their restrictions and rules and laws and all these kinds of things. And I'd say the number one frustration among Westerners, Western guide company owners and guides, is the not enough restrictions on Mount Everest, right? They would propose exactly what you just proposed, which is the way it is on a lot of other popular mountains. The problem is that, you know, Nepal is a pretty poor country, and they're weighing those restrictions with how that's going to get in the way of Nepalese people thriving, making more money, sending more kids to school, this sort of like upwardly mobile population because of the mountain. And in all honesty, you know, when it comes to like how many bureaus and organizations there are to make those rules, they seem to lean toward fewer rules so that the businesses have more freedom to do what they want. In other words, they're leaving it to the businesses to make those decisions. And that's pretty controversial. I totally agree with that I don't know, right? Here in the States, for instance, we would never do that, right? Because capitalism would drive that into a weird place. But they're letting capitalism run pretty rampant in the Khumbu Valley. And I'm guessing that that's going to probably bite them down the road a little bit. And it's also going to allow Mount Everest to turn into something kind of remarkable that we never would have thought it would for the country of Nepal. And just to say, just to speak to this thing about making it more exclusive, this is sort of me just guessing why maybe it doesn't go in that direction, but something interesting is happening. There are fewer Westerners climbing Mount Everest. There are fewer Kiwis, you know, Australians, Americans hiring guides to climb Mount Everest. And the reason why there's fewer Westerners doing it is because it's seen as too easy now. So back in the day when it was seen as much more difficult because the industry was younger and it was harder to climb, the older the industry was, they're less interested in it. On the other hand, the business that's booming is the Malaysians, the Chinese are coming in droves. And they're coming because the Nepalese-owned guiding companies are offering a price point that they can afford. And they have, you know, while a Western outfit these days might have 5 clients on Mount Everest, even the biggies, the legacy companies, the company next door, Nepalese-owned company next door, might have 100 clients. And they're charging half as much to climb, but it's so interesting to see what their client population looks like. It's countries you never would have imagined, you know, that would have turned to Everest as a thing to do. There's a lot of Asians. I mean, it's an Asian country. They probably see this as the way they want to go.
Yeah. I mean, it is closer, right? less of a barrier of getting there, you know, and I don't know. I anytime I hear the danger doesn't seem to be decreasing, but yet if the money's going down, that seems like a bad direction to go in. And, you know, you talked and remarked in that last answer about the perception. Obviously, Mount Everest has been, I think, at the center of our cultural imaginations for a long time, right? Even those of us, again, who never ventured a foot on a mountain are not only aware of it, but it is a commonly used analogy to illustrate other things within business, right? Like any seemingly insurmountable challenge, someone will be like, well, it's like climbing Mount Everest, right? Like if it's a easy.
It's the Mount Everest of.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Diving. It's the Mount Everest of, you know, businesses or, you know, whatever. Yeah,
absolutely. Mount Everest is the metaphor, right? And I'm curious in your mind, beyond its height, because there's many other tall mountains, right? You talk mm-hmm. about those who have made a challenge to themselves to have climbed all of the significant summits, right? I think there's 7 or 9 of them. I forget, right? But you know, so clearly, someone can say, "Hey, I climbed Kilimanjaro," right? Mm-hmm. Not an insignificant thing to have done.
yeah,
but there remains something about Mount Everest. Again, that seems to be more than its height, even though it is the tallest of those summits. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to walk through a little bit of why that is, right? Because this entire industry doesn't grow if that perception doesn't exist, right? So they seem to go hand in hand. So I want to give you an opportunity to share more about that.
Right. So, you know, the obvious first part of that is what you touched on is just our species obsession with the tallest, the fastest, the deepest, right? There, from an exploration standpoint, there's always that. However, that did kind of go away. Like once it became quite, I'm going to use the word easy loosely here, to climb Mount Everest, that went away. That's not really it. And I'm going to circle back to something that you and I already talked about a little bit and touches on the sort of who deserves to be there and who doesn't. So why are people drawn to it, right? It's kind of part of what we're asking, right? You know, it is the highest, but I don't think that's it. There's a probably one of my favorite people I talked to throughout this process was a woman named Heather McDonald, who happened to have been a mountain guide who guided up in the Pacific Northwest, but also guided on Mount Everest. She's now a clinical psychologist. So a lot of her reflection is about her work as a guide and sort of why, you know, who and why. And she put it into simple terms that allows a lot of empathy, in my opinion, right? She said there's three types of people that go to try and climb Mount Everest. And one is that person who's looking to awaken something inside, something that they actually feel maybe has died or is dying in their life, right? That could be a deeply personal inner trait to be, you know, it's not something obvious. The second kind of person would be someone who's looking to discharge something really negative in their life, like a divorce or a, you know, something that's gone on that's been kind of traumatizing, and they want to discharge that trauma. And the third thing are people who feel like they just need kind of this dramatic, you know, and in fact, death-defying experience to sort of renew their lust for life, right? That it's got to be something as dramatic as Everest to do that. And at the moment, it'll be interesting to see where we go. But at the moment, Everest symbolizes like an answer to all those questions, right? And that's the draw. That's the draw. I think that we have yet to see what the draw for some of the Asian, some of the Asian cultures might be different. You know, I'm speaking from a somewhat Western centric place, but I can't imagine it's too much different in some of these places. You know, some of those desires. So it's not the highest anymore. It's the ultimate symbol of blank to everybody. Does that make sense? And no, it's the filling in the blank is what makes it like, is the whole like, well, who deserves to be there and who doesn't? Like someone's going through a midlife crisis and that's the reason they did it. I don't know that I want to criticize that person.
That's a hell of a midlife crisis. Jeez Louise.
It is. Yeah.
There's got to be a simpler way. But
that's the crazy thing. For some, there's not. Right. That is the, you know, for some, they literally have to shake their life up in such a drastic way. And again, I don't know if I'm the person to judge whether that's good or bad.
No, I definitely feel that, cause that's what made me think of the question in the sense that there has to be something more going on here. This isn't just about scaling. It's not. Because when I was reading the book, it seems like, again, from the outside, it's a lot of man versus mountain. Mm-hmm. But it, or, you know, man in the euphemism, right? Like, obviously, yeah, men and women do scale the mountain. But it just started to seem like it was less about that, right? Like, they're not conquering this thing as much as it seemed more inward.
That's right. So, outward. Right? Because... Right, exactly. So climbing, mountaineering as a sport, classic man versus nature, man and woman versus nature, right? Classic. It's not that. It's just not that, right? Every step is marked to the top. You know, there's a rope kind of leading there to hold. It's man against themselves, him or herself, right? It's conquering something inside. I feel like that's probably 90% of the people that go there. The only problem is, as a lot of the guides pointed out, you know, you'll notice in the book, thankfully, these guides, right, I spoke to so many of them, are such, they're thoughtful people. They're very self-aware And I was really lucky with my interviews, you know, the amount of research I could do. But they talk a lot about knowing why you're there when you get to base camp. And one of the telltale signs when they know, ooh, this client is going to be a problem, are clients who are not quite sure why they're there, right? Maybe it's only for the selfie. Maybe it's so they can brag to friends, or, you know, an inferiority comp. I don't know. But there's a lot of reasons that set you up for failure and even danger to other people.
Absolutely. I could definitely understand that too. You know, it's like if you want to shake things up in your life, but you don't know why, you tend to start to get into bad habits, bad behaviors, things that are self-defeating, right?
And yeah.
All in the desire to kind of shake things up, but you got to go a little deeper than that. I do like the, you know, awaken, discharge, or dramatic death defying, defiance of death, right?
Yeah.
It really is fascinating stuff. Like, again, from someone who's a world away from these realities, it's completely fascinating just to jump into this book. And, you know, I purposefully didn't talk about the many personalities, but it reads like something out of an adventure novel at times, which even in the backdrop of this incredible business and industry with people's lives are so often at stake. It's a fascinating read. I want to get us into the final two segments of the show. The first one is Off the Dome, and Off the Dome are just some rapid fire questions. And these are really super easy. Now, as you said, you've never climbed Mount Everest, so this is more of a general climbing question. You are a climber.
Yeah.
What's the most misunderstood thing about climbing in general? When you tell people you're someone who climbs mountains, what's the thing that they most often will say where you're like, no?
This might get me in trouble or sound really weird, but at the level I climb, that it's risky.
Okay.
That's probably the biggest misconception, right? So the average person who doesn't understand climbing has a really interesting perception of being up high without any protection and dangling and, you know, being on the verge of death the whole way. And that's what's exhilarating. And it's actually the opposite. Okay. Climbers are kind of have OCD, and we're very obsessive about the gear and the safety and all these things. And once that's set up and you're doing moderately easy climbs, and by moderately easy, one of the climbed often. Right. There are climbs out there that are climbed hundreds of times in the season, mountains and rock climbs. And those ones in which it's been done so often are actually not that risky or dangerous. Right. If you're trained, if you know what you're doing. And so when you're going out for a day of climbing, it's not much different than going out hiking.
OK.
If you are a climber, and that no one seems to believe that.
OK.
You know, that seems to be like the sort of, there's no way, come on. They think it's an adrenaline sport,
yeah.
Which it's not. It's the opposite. You need a calm demeanor to do it right.
I could see that. And I will take your word for it, even as I'm, again, more the gentle hike guy. What is the one thing as a climber you must have that people wouldn't expect that you need? You know, and it doesn't have to be like specific climbing equipment, but like, what is the one thing in your history that you've been like, you know what? I didn't think I needed that, but I kind of really do need that every time I go.
Do you mean like in your backpack, literally a physical thing, like a thing that you would put into your backpack? Oof, that's a good question. You know, I guess number one, I always tend to go more food than I think I need. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that one thing about climbing and mountaineering is that you're not entirely sure how the day is going to end.
Yeah.
You're not entirely sure if the storm that you think has gone around you actually is coming for you, or something takes way longer than you think. So you have to do the hike down in the dark. There's all these things. And again, these aren't dangerous things. These are just things that you're kind of ready for in a day of climbing in the mountains. And, you know, you can't control the weather and all this stuff in the mountains. And it's just wonderful to have, you know, four more Clif Bars or peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know, when you would be bonking, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
You're never going to hear an argument from me having more food.
So. Yeah. I know, people say go light, right? People always talk about going light. And I guess that's the one place I never go light personally.
Yeah.
And, you know,
shed something else, but don't shed the food and don't shed the water.
That's right. That's right.
Now, again, one of these popular, I don't even know if this is true, but I've always heard this, that people are more afraid of speaking in public than heights, right?
Mm-hmm.
In your mind, what's scarier, the heights or speaking in public?
I mean, neither scares me too much, but I'm going to say the speaking in public.
Okay.
And it goes back to my answer about, because being up high, because of how safe it is. You know, I mean, there's a phobia, right? Where you get all like sweaty and queasy when you're, you know, and that's different.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
I don't tend to be afraid when I'm hanging off something very high up, because I know the rope that's attached to me could also hold a VW bug.
Okay. Can it really?
I mean, not quite, but yeah, it's like a ton or something, you know, the amount of weight that these little pieces of protection and ropes can take is incredible.
Huh.
And there are like four backing you up, by the way. I mean, there's one rope, but there's different pieces in the mountain. So don't forget, if one fails and the second fails, like there's still a third. It's wild when you do it right.
See, I watched that Sylvester Stallone movie when they was up there climbing, and I was like, nah, bruh.
No.
Right. Nah. I'm good.
Yeah.
Going out there to save, you know, it starts when they're going out there to try to save the woman that was dangling. And I was like, mm-mm.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Again, that was the setup for that movie, was that climbing is really dangerous.
Yeah.
Right.
Cliffhanger. Shout out to all the Cliffhanger fans out there, right?
Yeah.
John Lithgow playing a terrible villain.
The baddie. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So I want to get to the drop. And the drop is just our opportunity to share anything at all with our listeners. It doesn't have to be anything super serious, not as serious as climbing Mount Everest. It can be anything. And my drop is actually a show on Apple TV. It just came out, called Constellation. Apple TV has been really doing well in the science fiction genre. You know, they don't have a huge library of stuff, but what they do have that's in that sci-fi world is actually, I think, quite exceptional. I don't watch everything, but the things I have watched have been very good. And Constellation is one of their newest series. At the time we're recording this, it's newly out. So there's like three episodes, but I'm sure by the time this is actually out in the world, the series might be over. So people will be able to binge watch it if they get an opportunity. But really interesting premise so far. Have enjoyed watching it. And Constellation is my drop. So you're up, my friend.
Awesome. Well, I hope this isn't too obvious, but I am going to keep it in the family of folks who might be drawn to Everest Inc., right? Drawn to this story. I'm going to say climbing documentaries, a recent slew of climbing documentaries. And one thing that reinforced this was it was actually, you know, David Letterman, right? Of all people. Okay. He was on a podcast recently and said, you know, someone asked him like how he spends his time or something. And he said, I watch climbing documentaries late at night. He's become really obsessed with them. And I think this is the fun part about the book, Everest Inc., is it's sort of trying to explain why we're all so fascinated with this weird world.
Yeah.
And also trying to bring it down so it's a little less weird, right? That's the thing. So the climbing documentary specifically that I'll rattle off, I think there's four that are worth looking at. There's many more, but these are the ones. The first one that probably everyone knows is Free Solo. Right. That's the one
I've seen
about Alex Honnold free climbing the nose, El Capitan, or no, not the nose, a different route on El Capitan. But, you know, obviously an amazing thing to have an insight into his mind, climbing with no ropes, you fall, you die kind of energy. Jimmy Chin, of course, the director, brilliant, brilliant climber and photographer and director. That's an obvious one, and maybe a lot of people have seen it. But I always point people toward another one called The Alpinist. And The Alpinist follows this really young climber, Leclerc is his last name. He was Canadian. I think he was in his early 20s. And a lot of people would say, oh, that's the real Alex Honnold. Mm-hmm. And even Alex Honnold, I think, said something along those lines. Like, have you seen The Alpinist? And it's basically doing what Alex does, but kind of in a mountaineering, you know, ice climbing and mountaineering setting, which is 10 times more dangerous than what Alex Honnold is doing. So this guy is going off into the mountains alone, disappearing, often not telling people where he's going or how long he's going to be gone. I mean, it's fascinating getting into this guy's head. And the ending, I'm not going to give it away.
Okay,
that's,
good.
That's the one to really get into like a climber's mind and just sort of like relate a little bit if it's possible. And then we move into two documentaries, which are a little bit more rooted in the world I write about and a little bit more about that will give you the best insight into the industry today. And the first one is called Sherpa. Australian director, Jennifer Peedham, did it. She went to base camp in 2014 to do a documentary about the sort of special relationship between Sherpas and Westerners, mm-hmm. just sort of to talk about what that relationship was like, the state of it these days. And this was the year that the 16 Sherpas were killed in that avalanche in the Khumbu Icefall, which kind of upended the industry. A ridiculously sad moment for everybody. And just sort of like it was like a questioning whether the industry could even go on. So that documentary will basically give you the context for that turning point for what sort of, you know, which is a turning point that I talk about a lot in my book.
Yep.
And Jen Peedham was someone I interviewed a lot. And then the final one is actually about a Nepali named Nimsdai. And it's called 14 Peaks. And I believe Netflix, I'm not sure where it ended up, like maybe worldwide number 7 or something watched, right? It went crazy. And it's about this Nepali climber who was simultaneously trying to climb the 14 8,000 meter peaks in record time. He was also getting a guiding business going. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of like the celebrity of the guiding business over in Nepal. Very charismatic. Former Gurkha, Special Forces, super interesting guy, very tough, you know, a little flashy, but yeah. You know, that's his style and it's what he's known for. And he was going to set a new record. The previous person had climbed all 14 of those mountains in something like 7 years and something it had taken them to do. And he did all 14 in 7 months. And so that's what that documentary is about. And it was all with Sherpa guides, Sherpa infrastructure, Nepalese, mostly Sherpa, but Nepalese infrastructure. And it was just cool to see. It's basically completely outside the Western machine, completely.
And that
also takes you to the same place the book does.
I love it because you've given someone like myself, a notorious homebody, something to indulge in. I have seen Free Solo, to indulge in these other films without having to leave the safety of like the couch, which is very, very important to me.
Yeah.
Those are awesome drops. And like I said, seriously, you've given me a lot to kind of check out because they sound really, really interesting. Will, I want to thank you again for being on the show. Again, the book is called Everest Inc., The Renegades and Rogues Who Built an Industry at the Top of the World. And again, this is really, really fascinating stuff. Mount Everest remains in our imagination. And your book is going to play a role in that. So congratulations on the book. And thanks for being on a deep dive with me.
Yeah, thank you, Philip. I really appreciate you having me. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, brother.
Have a great one.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.